This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Lori Vallow-Daybell has now been convicted in three separate trials across two states by three different juries. She's serving seven life sentences. Her co-defendant husband is on death row. Her children's remains were pulled from a backyard. Her ex-husband was shot to death in her home. A man she allegedly targeted survived a bullet that shattered his car window and missed his head. Behind all that, the dead kids, the dead husband, the dead ex-wife, the doomsday theology, the zombie labels, the insurance fraud. She's now asking the Idaho Supreme Court to believe that she's the one who got cheated. Because she's Lori Vallow-Daybell. Now, is this going to go anywhere? No. In all likelihood, no. But it's part of the story. And we are storytellers. We tell you what's going on with these stories that we cover. And guess what? There's another story to tell about Lori Vallow-Daybell. So go get your milk and cookies and get comfy, because we're going to talk about Lori Vallow-Daybell's appeals. Da-da-da. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. As we work our way through some of the new developments here, I mean, who knows? I mean, that's the thing about the world we live in right now. It's like, could anything happen? Could she get it? Like, not likely. I mean, there's like zero grounds that seem very legitimate here. But you know what? I don't put anything past anything at this point. Anything can happen. That kind of feels like the world we live in. Anything can happen. So we might as well be prepared, right? At least aware of what's going on with the creatures that we watch in their cages. Her appeal is sitting in front of the justices right now. The briefs are filed, the arguments are made, and what she's asking for, a full reversal of her convictions, or at the very least, a brand new trial. Carries the legal weight of a woman who has lost every single time she stepped into a courtroom and still can't accept that the problem might be her. Let's talk about what this appeal journey actually looks like, not just the legal arguments. We covered those in detail months ago, but the full picture, because what happened since those briefs were filed tells you everything the Idaho Supreme Court needs to know. Here's where we are. May of 23, a jury in Ada County, Idaho, convicts Lori on first-degree murder in the deaths of her children, 7-year-old J.J. Vallow and 16-year-old Tylee Ryan. They also convict her of conspiring to kill Tammy Daybell, Chad's first wife. She gets five consecutive life sentences in Idaho, no parole ever, plus 10 years for grand theft because she kept collecting her dead children's Social Security benefits while they were buried in her husband's backyard. Her appellate attorney, Craig Durham, filed a brief in May of 25 laying out five constitutional violations. He says entitle her to a new trial or outright dismissal. In January 26, the state had fired back. Deputy Attorney General Jeff Nye files a 59-page response that systematically dismantles every one of those claims. And now, as of early April 26, Lori's reply brief has been filed, and the Idaho Supreme Court has the case. No date for oral arguments, no timeline for a decision. It could take months. It could take longer. But while all of that appellate machinery was grinding along in Idaho, Lori was busy in Arizona. And what happened there should tell the justices and all of us exactly what kind of defendant they're dealing with. Let's go back to April of last year, 25. She went to trial in Maricopa County for conspiring to kill Charles Vallow, her fourth husband. Remember this one? Charles was shot and killed by Lori's brother, Alex Cox, in her Chandler home in July of 2019. She claimed self-defense on Alex's behalf. Prosecutors said she orchestrated it for insurance money and to clear the path for Chad Daybell. She represented herself there. She's not a lawyer. The jury deliberated for about 3 hours and came back guilty. Then in June of 25, she went to trial again. Same courthouse, same judge for conspiring to kill Brandon Boudreau. her niece's ex-husband. Someone fired a rifle at Boudreaux from the back of Lori's Jeep while he was sitting in his car outside his home. Missed his head by a few inches. Again, she represented herself because she's just that bomb diggity lawyer. Or she's not. Again, she called no witnesses, and again, she presented no evidence. The jury deliberated 30 minutes. 30 minutes. That's less than the time most people spend deciding what to have for dinner. And then in July of 25, Judge Justin Bursky sentenced her to two consecutive life terms with the possibility of parole after 25 years on each. Stacked on top of the Idaho sentences, and before he did, he looked at her and said something that should echo through every filing in her Idaho appeal. He told her she had shown blatant disregard for humanity. He told her the amount of contemplation, calculation, planning, and manipulation that went into her crimes was unparalleled in his career. He told her she should never be released from prison. And then he said this, that eventually the cameras she seeks out and the media attention she craves would fade and she would drift into obscurity. That's the woman asking Idaho's highest court for another chance. And her behavior in those Arizona courtrooms wasn't just legally unsuccessful. It was also a masterclass in why the Idaho trial court's decisions were correct. And the Charles Vallow trial, jurors told reporters afterward that Lori spent most of the proceedings smiling and laughing. One juror said she didn't seem to take anything seriously. Another juror said he was initially on the fence but swung to guilty after the prosecution's closing. It was the text messages, he said, that sealed it. They uncovered lies. In the Boudreaux trial, her opening statement was so procedurally off the rails that the prosecution objected repeatedly. She compared conspiracy to Judas betraying Jesus for 30 pence of silver. The judge had to stop her and tell her she was arguing, not making an opening statement. Later in that same trial, she got into a confrontation with Judge Bursky. When he pushed back, she told him he didn't need to yell at her. He had her escorted out of the courtroom. And when she protested that she'd been courteous, the judge told her directly, no. She had been nothing close to courteous during the entire proceedings. She didn't present a single witness or a single piece of evidence in either Arizona trial. And when she was sentenced, she maintained her innocence, complained about jail conditions, and told the court that if she were accountable for these crimes, she would acknowledge it. This is a person who says the Idaho court violated her rights by removing an attorney who had a documented conflict of interest. This is the person who says the system failed her. Let's run through those five claims one more time, not to relitigate them, but because when you hear them stripped down to plain English, something becomes clear. Claim one, the court took away her chosen lawyer, Mark Means, violating her Sixth Amendment rights. What actually happened, Means simultaneously represented Lori and her co-conspirator husband. Chad paid for Means. Chad told Lori in a recorded jail call that Means was his attorney. You don't get to share the lawyer with the person you conspired with and then complain when the judge says it's a problem, especially when you've been found incompetent to waive that conflict. Claim two, her lawyer wasn't allowed to fight the disqualification in Chad's case. The disqualification hearing happened in Chad's proceeding because Lori's case was stayed for competency. Means tried to intervene and was denied. The state argues this wasn't a critical stage of Lori's prosecution. It's a procedural argument, and it's a thin one. Claim three, the court made decisions while she was incompetent. This one has a surface appeal. Competency matters, but the state's position is pretty straightforward. You don't freeze the entire legal system indefinitely because a defendant can't participate. You handle what's necessary, protect the defendant's core rights, and revisit when competency is restored, which is what happened. Claim four, they let Arizona evidence in that poisoned the jury. The Charles Vallow shooting, the Boudreaux drive-by. The defense says it was character assassination. The state says it was pattern recognition. It's evidence. Same actors, same methods, same financial motives applied across multiple victims. That's exactly what Rule 404B allows. You can show prior acts to establish intent, plan, and modus operandi. But here's what the Arizona convictions now underscore. That evidence wasn't prejudicial overkill. It was accurate. Three separate juries have now confirmed those patterns were real. Claim 5, her speedy trial rights were violated because nearly 2 years passed between indictment and trial. She spent 353 days in competency evaluations, either at her own request or not attributable to the state. She requested the venue change from Fremont County to Ada County, which required massive logistical coordination. The case was sprawling, multiple victims, multiple defendants, enormous discovery. The state put it bluntly in their brief. All she has going for her on this claim is the length of the delay, and that runs directly into the complexity of the case and the fact that she caused most of the delays herself. When you hear all five laid out like that, they don't sound like winning arguments, now do they? They sound like someone looking for a technicality in a case where the facts buried her. And that brings us to what this appeal really reveals, not as a legal matter, but as a window into who Lori Vallow Daybell is even now. Every single claim follows the same logic. Reframe her own choices as her own circumstances, as someone else's failure. She picked the conflicted attorney. She was too incompetent to participate in proceedings. She requested the venue change that added months to her timeline. And now she wants the court to treat all of that as evidence that the system wronged her. It's the same framework that ran through the entire case. The children weren't children anymore. They've been taken over by dark spirits. Charles wasn't Charles. Tammy had to go because the mission required it. Every escalation was someone else's fault. Every death was justified because inside a belief system she built specifically to justify it. At her Idaho sentencing, she looked at the courtroom and said that Jesus Christ knows no one was murdered in this case. At her Arizona sentencing, she said if she were accountable, she'd acknowledge it, as if accountability is something that happens to you rather than something you owe. That's not a legal defense. That's a woman so deep in her own construct that reality can't reach her. The appeal isn't a departure from the pattern. It's a continuation of it. She's still the protagonist. She's still the one being persecuted. The only difference is the venue. Instead of preaching about light and dark things to a circle of true believers, she's filling constitutional claims with Idaho's highest court. The audience has changed. The performance hasn't. The Idaho Supreme Court will rule when it rules. That could be months from now. When it does, the justices will have before them the trial record, the state's 59-page rebuttal, the defense replying the full weight of what's happened since. Three guilty verdicts in three courtrooms, a defendant who represents herself and lost spectacularly both times. A sentencing judge who told her she'd fade into obscurity and a pattern of behavior that hasn't shifted one degree since the day those children went missing. The appeal isn't going anywhere. Not because the system is stacked against Lori Vallow Daybell, not because she didn't get a fair trial, but because the evidence was overwhelming. The jury got it right, and nothing she's raised on appeal changes that fundamental reality. JJ was 7 years old. Tylee was 16. They didn't get five constitutional claims. They didn't get reply briefs or oral arguments. They didn't get to stand in front of a panel of justices and explain why someone violated their rights. They got a backyard in rural Idaho and a mother who, to this very moment, has never once publicly taken responsibility for what happened to them. Seven life sentences across two states, three juries, three guilty verdicts, and she still thinks the problem is the process. Some appeals are a legitimate exercise of the rights our system guarantees to every defendant, even the ones who don't deserve our sympathy. And some appeals are just the last move left on a board where every piece has already been taken. This one isn't about justice. It's about a woman who ran out of believers and is now trying to convince a court instead. The justices will see through it. Everyone else already has. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Left for you to weigh in. Links are in the description. The appeal isn't going anywhere, not because the system is stacked against Lori Vallow Daybell, not because she didn't get a fair trial,
because the evidence is overwhelming. The jury got it right, and nothing she's raised on appeal changes that fundamental reality. Links are in the description. We'll continue it there. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you get podcasts. You don't miss any of our conversations of this and the many other stories we follow for you right here. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.